Some of the early stuff I did with him will always be favorites because we were left totally alone and nobody was paying attention to what we were doing. And so that, for a composer, that's pure pleasure. A director is just saying, do whatever you want, and nobody from the studio seems to even be aware that we're even doing it. That's heaven.
That's Danny Elfman describing the work he's done with Tim Burton. They've had an ongoing working relationship now for 30 years, creating 17 films together. It's been a pretty exciting collaboration. And now, one of the things that's putting Danny Elfman back into that heavenly space is diving into the world of classical music. That's right. He has a new recording out, and it celebrates his violin concerto, 1111, and also a really fun piano quartet. This is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Macher. I'm talking with Danny Elfman about his latest recording, 1111. Danny, you are one of the most in-demand Hollywood film composers. Some of the most cherished film and TV scores have your signature on them, everything from Batman to The Simpsons and Desperate Housewives. And yet, this is a path that you hadn't really imagined for yourself growing up in Los Angeles. How did music become your accidental profession?
Well, it's just as you said, it was really accidental. It fell into my lap. I mean, not fell into my lap. That makes it sound like it was easy. My path was jolted from where I thought I was going, which was a career in film production, perhaps being an editor or cinematographer. That was my interest, to music. And it happened, I can't tell the whole story because it's so... it's got so many twists and turns. There's no like super short version, but the shortest version would be this. When I got into high school, music was never on my radar. I had no musical background and I played no instruments and I didn't consider myself a musical person. And I literally went to a new high school and made new friends and they were musicians. They just happened to be. And I was kind of the not musician kind of friend of people who were more musical. And I decided I was going to leave school 6 months early and go travel around the world. And I thought I'd take an instrument with me just for the hell of it. And I decided to take a violin. And so my interest in music all started in those high school years, hanging out with other musicians who turned me on to a lot of great music, including music that changed my life, you know, like Stravinsky, for example. When I first heard The Rite of Spring and then more of his work and then got led to Prokofiev and other Russian composers, Shostakovich. It was like my whole world turned upside down. There was this whole thing that I never knew of. And then I was also at the same time had a friend that was a percussionist and he was turning me on to modern percussion composition, Terry Riley, Lou Harrison. I became kind of infatuated with a wild percussion instrument builder composer named Harry Parch. And so it was just one of those crazy things. My interests changed. And then I went around the world, but I started in Paris. And my brother happened to be performing conga as a drummer with a French musical theatrical troupe. And they actually hired me to play violin. And I'd only been playing for 4 or 5 months. And that kind of started me performing. And then it was like, I kind of like performing. This is cool. But it couldn't have been further from any of my dreams or aspirations up until that moment at 18 years old.
That's so interesting because I've been having a lot of conversations with different artists in the last few weeks. And, you know, we talk about, could this happen today, in today's music world? Do you think what happened to you is also something that could be recreated in any way now, in this day and age?
Oh, yeah, of course. It just takes somebody suddenly seeing something or hearing something and getting inspired and changing directions. You know, it's always possible at any point in one's life to change directions, or at least to attempt to change directions, I should say, because to successfully change directions, of course, involves a lot of hard work and a lot of luck. But I did both. I just really dived in And my brother started this musical theatrical troupe called the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo. And I came back from a year traveling in Africa and became a street performer. So that wasn't on my radar either. I never expected to be literally blowing fire and playing trombone and passing the hat on the streets of Los Angeles, but that's what I was doing. And yeah, things just happened. I was driven to get myself better because I was a street musician, but suddenly I was writing crazy compositions and I wanted to learn how to write music. And so I was listening to tons of 1930s music at that time. I listened to a lot of Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, Django Reinhardt. Django Reinhardt was actually the reason I picked up violin. And so I started teaching myself to transcribe Duke Ellington arrangements. And I wanted to actually perform those note accurate. So I started training myself.
So are you fully self-trained then as a musician?
Oh, yeah, I'm fully self-trained. I've never taken a lesson.
Wow.
Well, let me put it this way. I tried taking a couple lessons when I got back, and I failed miserably. Weirdly, I found that I could play a musical instrument in front of hundreds of people, or later, thousands of people, but not one person. I absolutely couldn't do it. And I froze every time I was trying to take a lesson and play back music in front of a teacher.
You probably aren't the only one.
No, I like to try to give encouragement to people that, you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat. And of course, I think the best possible way to enter a career in music is to study music. Study it. Do what I didn't do. You know, don't be that kind of weird, do everything through the back door kind of person. Because I could tell you for a fact that doing it that way is much harder. I mean, it's a hard way to do it. I put in thousands of hours. And, you know, they say that old thing about 10,000 hours to get good at anything. I couldn't agree more. That's really about right.
Well, I have a couple of other quick questions, and then we'll dive into this recording that I want to talk with you about. Your big break came with Pee Wee Herman's Big Adventure, and that was your first collaboration with director Tim Burton. Did you really have the theme for that written before you were officially signed up for it?
Well, no. Yes and no. Basically, it was like this. I met with Tim Burton. When I met with him, I didn't even understand that he was looking for a score. I thought he was looking for a song, because at that point now, I'd moved on to the second phase of my career. I was now in a band. I suddenly woke up one morning. I'd been in a theater group for 7 years, and I said, I want to be in a band. I want to start a ska band. I heard ska music from England, and I said, that's what I want to do. And I just switched completely. So now it's a couple years into that, and I was starting to get some songs in films, and people were interested in putting songs. So I thought that's why I was meeting him. And when he said, I'm actually interested in a score to the movie, I was like, why me? And he was like, I don't know. I think you could kind of do it. I think you could just do it. And he showed me some scenes from the movie, and I really liked him. We had a lot in common. So I didn't write it before I met with him, but on the way home from that meeting, I was hearing music in my head. And I got back to my little studio, meaning I had a 4-track tape recorder and, you know, a couple of different synthesizers, and I made a demo of the music I was hearing in my head from that meeting. And I think it was about a week or two later, I get a call back saying, you got the job. And that demo, that piece of music, ended up becoming the main title, you know, music for Pee-wee's Big Adventure. So technically, thematically, I wrote the theme before I saw the whole movie. But, you know, I had seen scenes from the movie that made me think of it. So it wasn't like out of the blue or anything. I was looking at Pee-wee riding his bicycle, and it made me think of like a 1960s Italian comedy. There was something about it that felt, it just wasn't a normal American comedy. There was something weird and out of time and out of place. And so at that moment, it was still in the period where I was like, grew up on listening to so much of Nino Rota's music, who's the composer for Gigo Fellini. So that kind of, that tone of Nino Rota stuck in my head. It's like, oh, it'd be fun to apply this to Pee-wee. I don't know why, but I expected the music to get thrown out. I honestly did. I didn't expect the score to survive at all, but I decided I'll learn something from this. It'll be a good experience for me, even though it's unlikely I'll hear this music actually in the movie. But it did end up in the movie, so it was a happy ending.
Well, you've worked with Tim Burton for what, more than 3 decades now?
Yeah, 17 films, 3 decades, yeah.
So what is it about this creative partnership that just keeps clicking for the two of you?
You know, I never know the answer to that. There's a lot of creative partnerships like that in films. You know, the most famous would be John Williams and Steven Spielberg, or certainly Sergio Leone and Marconi. And my favorite relationship from the past that inspired me was Alfred Hitchcock and Bernard Herrmann. And what makes relationships work is just hard to say. I think it just comes to a chemistry, a personal chemistry between the director and the composer.
Do you have a favorite project that you've worked on together, or is it sort of like selecting your favorite child?
Yeah. I mean, there's different parts of different films where I got to do something fresh, and that's always my favorite moments. You know, some of the early stuff I did with him will always be favorites because we were left totally alone and nobody was paying attention to what we were doing. And so that, for a composer, that's pure pleasure. A director is just saying, do whatever you want, and nobody from the studio seems to even be aware that we're even doing it. That's heaven.
I read an interview that you did recently, actually, and here's what it said. You've composed more than, 100 film scores, and each one has taken you months to complete, yet you have a feeling that you're probably going to be remembered best for a piece that you wrote in one day, which is the theme tune for The Simpsons.
Yeah.
So my question is, what would you like to be remembered for?
Well, I'd rather be remembered for 11/11. I mean, I'd rather be remembered for Alice in Wonderland or Batman or Nightmare Before Christmas or, you know, any number of dozens of other films or Milk. But realistically, it's going to be that one day job. And that's just called luck. That's just, you know, when I wrote the theme for The Simpsons, I looked at a early pencil sketch of the opening of the show, and I met with Matt Groening and he told me about it. And once again, I had this strong feeling of retro, you know, in the same way that when I saw Pee-wee riding his bicycle, they said, this doesn't feel like a modern contemporary comedy. This feels like some kind of weird older thing. And when I saw the beginning of The Simpsons, I said, this is like a crazy Hanna-Barbera show that I never saw. And maybe it was slightly reminiscent of seeing like the beginning that I grew up on, the Flintstones, where he's also riding to work, although his feet are propelling the car. But there's kind of a slight kind of similarity. And I said to Matt, I said, if you want something really like crazy old school, I think I'd love to do it. If you want something contemporary, I'm not the guy. Just because at that point, television themes were just boring as hell. I shouldn't just say boring as hell. They were all tending to sound kind of the same, kind of big band, small orchestra, or a band with a rock band playing with it kind of sound. And some of them are classic, you know, so I'm sorry. I really take back, you know, because some of the stuff is cheesy, but I have to say I love some of that cheesiness. So bad is the wrong word. Some of it is kind of cheesy and some of that cheesiness is fantastic, but I didn't want to do that. And Matt said, yeah, I think that's the way to go. And this was another one of those weird lucky breaks where the Simpsons theme I wrote in my head in the car on the way home, the whole thing. By the time I got home, it was done. Now, I have to say, that's almost never happened to me. So it's not like that's how it works. You know, I go and I see the movie and I got the whole thing in my head on the way home. This was just one of those moments. And since I already talked about doing the same thing for Pee-wee's Big Adventure, I realize it's going to sound like it's always like that. But you just happen to pick the two things that it was like that. I literally heard it on the way home. And in this particular case, I ran into my studio before I listened to any other music. And I recorded a demo of the entire piece, fully orchestrated, ready to go, exactly as it is in the show. The only difference is it was on synthetic instruments instead of orchestra. And I got a call back from Matt saying, yeah, that's fine, let's do it. And it was just the easiest thing I've ever done. I mean, it took me about 4 hours of work, top to bottom, to kind of make this demo and complete it and make it sound good, get the parts tweaked, orchestrate it, and print it all and send them a cassette. But that was it. Once that was done, it's like, that's exactly what we recorded, I think, a week later. And yeah, on my gravestone, if I die today, it'll go, he wrote the Simpsons theme. Or it'll just be Homer Simpson going, duh, or something like that.
Or a donut or something.
Or a donut. Yeah, exactly. So the slaving I did for 11/11, which, 6 months of work as opposed to the one day for Simpsons, will be overshadowed. And that is like one of the things that irks me when I do performances of 11/11 and I'm showing up for symphony orchestras, all over, and it'll say in the program, writer of themes like The Simpsons. And I'm going, oh my God, they're coming to a violin concerto from the guy who wrote The Simpsons.
You know what, though?
I think that's not getting them in the right frame of mind, but I can't deny it. It's a fact, so.
Well, and
I
want to point out the fact that having that as your, on your list of accomplishments could very well bring new people into the concert hall. And that is not a bad thing at all.
No, that isn't. Well, that is actually what motivated me to start doing concert music. The challenge, obviously, which I needed, but it was performing around the world with Elfman Burton. Means it's the show that we've been doing of 15 suites of Tim Burton's music to his movies. And, it's something we do with the full orchestras, and the audiences are so enthusiastic and great. And I kept feeling that these audiences should come into the concert houses. And I don't think a lot of them listen to classical music. I started to develop a theory about how there's like a film music orchestral audience and there's a classical orchestral audience. And there's got to be a way to try to bring them together. And I became motivated, like the next piece I write, which ended up being 11/11, to do it in a way that might have elements of myself in it, that if I could bring people in from these film music concerts into there, it'll stretch their concepts of what they think of me as doing. And it'll be kind of forcing them a little bit out of their comfort zone. But yet, I think they'll appreciate it. And the first night we played it was in Prague, and it was a concert of the violin concerto and film music. So 100% of the audience was there to hear my film music, and because this had never been performed. And it was such a great vindication for me because I sat there in a box watching the audience intently during the concerto, and I didn't know whether I'd be able to capture their imaginations and hold them, whether it would be asking too much of them. And it wasn't. I mean, they sat there really, really listening. And the response, it was so gratifying, all the work that I'd put into that, that I felt like this, at this moment, this experiment was a success. And it's just encouraged me to go much more deeply into that world, which is now virtually every year for me. Is a chunk of my year I'm giving over to concert music.
That's pretty spectacular. Thank you for that, for those of us who are in the classical music world.
Oh, you're welcome. I mean, I'm on my, after 11/11, I was asked to do a piano quartet for the Berlin Philharmonic Piano Quartet. And that also got released on the recording with 11/11. And I just finished a percussion quartet, which will be played along with a percussion quartet that Philip Glass wrote in October. And I'm in the middle of a symphonic piece for the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain right now and having a great time. And I've got my next two concertos already planned after this. So I'm absolutely dead serious about the excitement of moving into this world, or trying to batter my way into this world, is really what it comes down, because the symphony orchestras are extremely resistant for reasons which I was expecting, because I'm a successful film composer. And it's funny, when I got into film composition, they all hated me because I came from rock and roll. And it's like, you can't go from rock and roll into film composition. And then I became a successful film composer, and then I decide I want to break into the classical world. And they're going, no, you're a film composer. We don't want you here. And so it's actually kind of fun at this point in my life, feeling the same uphill battle that I've felt my entire life for everything I've done all over again. And I find that resistance weirdly somewhat motivating.
Well, and you're not the only composer who's faced that. I just was reading an article about Eric Korngold, in The New Yorker, because he was a classical composer who then when he came to the States, went to Hollywood and started writing film scores. And then when he wanted to go back to writing concerti, people wouldn't take him seriously again. It took a lot for him to rebuild his reputation. So it seems like we got to get beyond that.
Yeah, and it's absolutely true. And it's something I've been very much aware of when I was writing the violin concerto. I was given some advice by another classical musician whose name I won't mention, but he's, very well known. And he took me aside and he said, make sure you end up putting your personality into this concerto because some film composers make, whether it's a mistake or not, it remains to be seen. But what they find is that there's a serious side to them that they left behind when they went from their orchestral training into film music, and they want to regain that, and their audience finds themselves removed, alienated, because they go to listen and they can't find the personality that they think of being that composer. And it's something I carried in the back of my mind all the time, that if I want to connect with that audience, I have to make sure that bits of my own musical identity and personality get carried into this world so they can go, oh yeah, that's him. that there'll be those satisfying moments of like, oh, that's definitely him.
So how did you do that in your violin concerto 1111?
I was very intimidated when I was asked in Prague, would you be interested in doing a concerto? We'd just done Elfman Burton. Sandy Cameron had just played in that concert because she wrote a cadenza that I wrote for the Edward Scissorhands suite, and they loved it. And they approached me right after the concert and said, how about writing a concerto for her? And of course, me being me, I thought about it for 3 seconds and I said, okay, sure. And it wasn't until about months later that I thought, what did I actually just agree to? And then I started consuming mass quantities of violin concertos. And by the way, including Korngold's. But I started with a list of about 25 composers and then narrowed it down to about 6 and then 3. And I just listened and listened and listened, and I soaked up violin concertos and violin concertos. And it became clear to me that this was going to be much harder than I was expecting when I flippantly said, yeah, sure, I can do that. Because it's a specific kind of a discipline. And when I take on a project, I want to do that. I don't just want to write something that has a violin in it and call it my violin concerto. I mean, that would be easy. I want it to feel like a violin concerto. I want it to have the complexity and the nuances and the intensity of a good violin concerto. And so I realized that that was going to be seriously challenging and way outside of my wheelbase. And then, of course, that itself got me very excited. I said, this is like a whole new universe for me.
You have a thing for the number 11, and that's the name of the concerto, 1111. Would you explain what your thing is for the number 11 and how it also just serendipitously worked out for this concerto?
Really bizarre. This is a weird story, but I swear to God it's true. My thing with number 11 is just literally my name, Elfman. We've never found a meaning for Elfman, and Elf means 11 in German, of course. And so I've had a lifelong story about the origin of my name. And the story is, in the Jewish religion, every ceremony has to have 10 to begin. And so the 10th man, the minion, becomes this crucial figure. You can't start without the minion. My ancestor was late, always, and was always the one after that, the unessential 11th person showing up going, I'm here. And they go, ugh, you're too late, but sit down, it's okay. And hence the name Elfman, the 11th man, the unessential, slightly late 11th man. And now, of course, I'm sure that's not true, but that's my story of how the origin of my name. But it did give me this fascination with the number 11 because of Elf. And it was Sandy, as we were really finishing the last cadenza, and I've never counted the number of bars. She said, let's count the bars. She says, it's got to be over 1,000 by now. It would be fantastic, wouldn't it, if it was like 1,100 and something with your name and your whole thing about the number 11? And I said, yeah, that'd be cool. So she started counting two of the movements, and I started counting two of the movements, and we totaled it up on the phone. And it's like, I don't believe this. It's 1,111 measures. Exactly. So I said, that just has to mean something. I don't know what. You know, I don't believe in universal cosmic messages. On the other hand, it seemed to be more than a coincidence to just ignore. And as of that moment, I said, all right, this is definitely the 1111. It just seemed too strange.
One of the things I hear is like leitmotif, you know, where you have a theme that represents a character. And I just think that's something that I have heard in your music.
You know, when I listened to mid-20th century classical music, it was film music. And film music was classical music. But the leitmotif is the driving connection between these things. And I've always felt that if I can give any audience a melody to carry them along, then what I do around that melody, I could really twist it and turn it and screw it up. I could mess with harmonies. I could turn things sideways and upside down. But there's still that bit of a thing for their ear to follow. And that, to me, is what Shostakovich, what Prokofiev, what the composers I loved so much did so beautifully. And that's constantly what I'm trying to do. So when I start writing classical music, I was very consciously attempting to take leitmotif, to take a bit of melody and surround it by anything I want, but put a melody in there. And it's funny because I went out to dinner with a certain musician and his old teacher after a concert at Disney Center. And his teacher was talking to me, and I mentioned, oh, I'm working on a violin concerto. And he took me aside. He said, please give it some melody. And I thought that was so funny because he was like, we're just not hearing very much of that in contemporary composition. And I said, believe me, that's my intention. I love working and twisting and playing, taking a melody and turning it into a softball and batting it around and seeing if I could make it rubber. I mean, the whole pleasure of the third movement, which is my favorite, was really, what can I do with four notes? And a simple melody, you know, can I make that go a minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 7 minutes? It was just purely an experiment in myself to take, in fact, a simple motif and to say, what can you do with this? It's like a challenge. It was like a throwdown that I gave myself. And so that's why that movement is kind of my favorite right now, because it was like a personal challenge to just take this very, very simple motif and kind of play with it. My intention symmetrically was that the first and the last movement would have strongest ties to neoclassical, recognizable music as we kind of know it. And the second and third movement would consciously veer off to the left and the right and get off track from that. And both of them are based on simple motifs. There is actually a strong Bernard Herrmann influence in the second movement. Mm-hmm. that was the intended symmetry of 1111, was to kind of start and finish it in a little more recognizable form, and then in the middle to take my audience on a little more of a journey.
I wanted to ask you about the piano quartet, because like many composers who have used folk melodies for inspiration, you have decided to take a timeless taunt that kids like to say, and you have incorporated that into this piano quartet.
Well, you know, when I took on the quartet, I just wanted to have fun with it. That was really my goal, you know, have fun with this. And for some reason, it somehow, I was kind of playing and doodling a melody, and it reminded me of that. And I thought, well, why not? I mean, Bartok and Stravinsky and so many composers took folk melodies and turned them into wonderful compositions. And I called Knut, the cellist in the quartet in Berlin, and I said, I was wondering, because I didn't know if it was just an American thing or not. And I said, is there a taunt that schoolyard children would use, like, nya-nya-nya-nya-nya? And he goes, oh, yes, yes, that's, you know, we have that in Germany also. So I was like, okay, good. So it really is kind of a universal thing, or at least it's more than simply the American schoolyards. And I just decided to have fun with it and see what I can do with it.
Are you finding that you have more or less freedom when you're composing classical music?
Well, about 1,000 times more freedom, but that's also the terrifying part. You know, obviously, when I sit down to write a film score, I have image in front of me, and the image is telling me something. It's telling me to go into a certain world, a certain universe. When I'm sitting down to write pure composition, it's like, you know, it's the feeling that I used to have when I was writing a song, being with the band ages ago. There's nothing. I could do anything. And it's kind of scary. And it's a bit paralyzing. That, you know, the first time I encountered this is when I wrote a piece about 13, 14 years ago called Serenata Schizophrena. And that was my first ever orchestral commission for American Composers Orchestra. And it was going to be performed at Carnegie. And so I went there to visit. And I met with them, and I was looking in the hallway, and there was original scores from, like, the great composers. And I was like, oh, shit, this is, like, the real deal. And I went home, and I was like, you know, there really is a Prokofiev and a Brahms and a Shostakovich and a Stravinsky and a Bartok. And I'm, like, a kindergartner in the big kids' playground right now. And I found it somewhat paralyzing. I don't belong here. I'm not worthy. You know, it was actually really Shostakovich and Prokofiev that helped me along, because Shostakovich, I went and listened to his jazz concerto, which is so lighthearted and just kind of loose and free and whimsical. And then I listened to some of Prokofiev's Lieutenant Key J and a couple other pieces that I knew of his, and my favorite Stravinsky piece, which is L'Estoile du Soldat, which is also very whimsical. And I was like, you know what? Just because I'm in their world, it doesn't mean I can't be fun and kind of just, you know, make something whimsical and enjoyable that's not necessarily heavy and with the weight that I imagine when I think of the big symphonic works. And so it kind of encouraged me, just go ahead and start. I understand that I'll never be Shostakovich and I'll never be Prokofiev, and God knows I'll never be Stravinsky. But it's like, that's okay. I kind of felt a permission to kind of, you know what, be yourself, do your thing, and don't worry about what it's like being in the shadow of true geniuses. You know, they're just the inspiration, the thing that I'll reach for, that I know I'll never quite ever reach. But that doesn't stop me from, once I get deep into my own world, when I'm deep in writing, I'm just in my own universe, and it's like I'm happy there. When I start a composition, I feel like I'm pushing a train uphill that has no locomotive. And I'm shoving and pushing, and it's all my strength, and it feels impossible. And then finally, the track levels out, and I'm pushing it along, and it's still a lot of effort, but it's a level ground, so I'm not killing myself. And then when I'm lucky, I reach a point where it's downhill now, and the composition is now leading me. I'm not telling it where to go. And I jump on top, and now it's a wild ride. And that train could be suddenly following a track along a cliff, you know, with 1,000-foot drops on both sides. And I really don't care. It's like, I'm fine now. I don't know where it's going, and that's the joy of it.
An unessential, slightly late 11th man? Well, it seems like Danny Elfman is always on top of it, as he is with his new recording, which we're celebrating this week on New Classical Tracks. If you're enjoying New Classical Tracks, the absolute best thing you can do for the show is to tell somebody about it, help spread the word, and also take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. Special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher.